My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pyle and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
We go straight into the first round, which is about words, this week about some useful, but perhaps not very often used, verbs. Two marks, if I can be told, what activity these verbs are trying to define. Beginning with Dennis Norden. Dennis, yours is to absquatulate. A-B-S-Q-U-A-T-U-L-A-T-E, absquatulate.
I think it's probably the only word in the language that begins A-B-S-Q.
Yeah.
For the benefit of people who don't so much study this for the English, but for the Scrabble possibility. And I associate it with books like The Magnet of My Youth, where Hari Ramsit Jam Singh used to say, let us absquatulate yourself. And it's this kind of activity that was indulged in by people like Christmas club treasurers and bookies. In other words, they made off when they should have stayed where they were.
Very hurriedly.
Very hurriedly.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Two marks. It means that, to decamp or abscond. Oddly enough, it can also mean to squat, but that, I don't think it's in England. This is an American word, and it came over here in about 1860 and became totally obsolete by 1900. Dennis Powers next, and your verb, Dennis, is to nidify, N-I-D-I-F-Y, or it can be nidificate, if you prefer.
Does a very remote acquaintance with French help?
Yes, it would.
It does. Well, nid, or knee, means a nest.
Nidify?
A nidify would mean to bring straws home and make a nest.
Quite right. To build a nest, or more than one nest, if you want. Come on. Frank Muir, to sniggle. S-N-I-G-G-L-E, sniggle.
I think this is one of those portmanteau words, like to strom, which is halfway between stroll and roam. To sniggle means to, it's halfway between a snigger and a giggle. It's one of those things where you go.
No. You better get to country sports.
It's one of those things where you hurl the cheese at the the pegs.
It's more watery.
So I've got a sniggle there.
Yes. Is there a game of sniggle in the water?
Well,
we'll throw the sniggle.
You do it in a curious way.
You do, you throw the sniggle.
But you've got to explain why
sniggle,
and what you're doing.
Is there any connection between sniggle and wiggle?
At the other end of a sniggle is a very nice wiggle.
The girl can.
Yes, striptease.
No. It's still watery. Think of the most wiggly, watery
a
creature
snake.
That you can think of.
It's tadpole.
Not wiggly
frog.
Enough.
To sniggle is to
catch a frog.
Is to catch a tadpole and put it in a jam jar full of warm water.
I give you one mark. You've got the wrong creature, and that's why I say it was wiggly. It's to fish for eels by pushing a baited hook into their hiding places, because snig is one of the dialect words for a river eel. So sniggling, you're catching them.
Well, I was warm.
Eel's very cold. One more. Anne Scott James, to transmogrify, T-R-I-N-S-M-O-G-R-I-F-Y, transmogrify.
This seems to be another rather etymologically unsound word. When Zeus transformed himself into a swan,
yes,
or a bull,
yeah,
or a golden shower, or a peacock, might it be said that he transmogrified
yes,
himself?
Yes, I'm doing it as often as that. It might well be called transmogrification.
Might well.
Yes, two marks. It's a, yes. It's a sort of concocted word. It might have an origin in transmigration, though nobody's quite certain. And it means to alter or transmute your form or appearance, and to do it perhaps in a pretty grotesque way. 2 marks, Anne. Before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations that Frank and Dennis have been given for the last round. And Dennis, yours is, "If I were a bell, I'd be ringing." And yours, Frank, "Where are the snows of yesteryear?" So we come in round two to a round of possible literary myths. 2 marks, can you give me a reason why some doubt might be cast on the following generally accepted beliefs? Dennis Norden, that Napoleon was the first to describe the English as a nation of shopkeepers.
Presumably because he wasn't.
Yeah. I think that's probable.
Shop stewards. I know, it was a corruption. You breathe deeply there, Anne. Was that...
Just because I thought it was so difficult, that was all.
Oh, that's great help. Well, sympathy is nearly as good as assistant. I don't know. Nation of... he didn't say that at all.
I think he did, but...
Oh.
I think what he in fact said was sono mercante, which is, as far as I know, either Italian or Corsican Italian.
Oh, yes.
Just great
of my auntie. Yeah. Well, presumably he wasn't... You say he was the first to say it.
That's what the belief is.
Ah, well, the belief is wrong. He was the third to say it.
I think you're dead right. I'll give you your 2 marks. This is a bit difficult. There was a chap called Adam Smith who wrote The Wealth of Nations, and in 1775 he coins the phrase, "To found a great empire may appear a project fit only for a nation of shopkeepers." And it's known that Napoleon read Adam Smith, but he also had another Corsican chum, he was a Corsican, called Paoli, who probably said it in about the same year, so that's number two. And then there's another American called Samuel Adams, who in 1776 used a similar phrase, and it's only long after Napoleon's death that the phrase was attributed to him. So he probably used it, but not the first.
Yeah, he was the fourth by your count.
Third or fourth, yes, I'm not quite certain about it. But don't spell, this is, I hope, a bit easier, that the belief that Cinderella wore glass slippers.
Well, I believe there's a kind of ancient belief that didn't really mean glass, it was fur.
Absolutely right. Just to enlarge that a little, in an early French version of the fairy story, Cinderella wore pantoufles en verre, V-A-I-R, which means a kind of white or bluish-grey fur, probably made from squirrels. And this was mistranslated by Charles Perrault. He mistook V-A-I-R for V-E-R-R-E, which means a glass. And it's been glass slippers ever since, which makes it extremely awkward in pantomimes. I mean, much easier if we've done it in fur. And you get your 2 marks. Thank you. Yours, Frank. The belief that the Duke of Wellington remarked that the Battle of Waterloo was won in the playing fields of Eton.
Well, he didn't say it. It's the myth.
We can't prove that one way or other, I think.
Well, yep. I think we can, can't we not? Can we not? Can't we? It's, it was one of those things that was written.
Yes.
By a French historian and political philosopher called Montalembert.
Quite right.
And the family, the Duke of Wellington's family, is always strenuous. He denied he ever said it. Mm-hmm. So he didn't say it.
I think...
He never said lots of things attributed to him.
But for knowing about Montalembert doing this, I'm going to give you 2.5 marks. It was pretty good. Montalembert didn't write until 1855, which was 40 years after the Battle of Waterloo, and he was writing a book about, or treatise about, the future, the political future of England. He probably got it wrong. But the reason why it's unlikely that Wellington ever said this was that in 1815, or a bit before, there were no field or organised games at Eton at all, and didn't have any playing fields.
Oh.
So, 2.5 marks. Anne Scott James, your takes goes back a bit further, the belief that Eve gave Adam an apple in the Garden of Eden.
Well, I can only assume that, botanically speaking, there weren't any apples around at that time, and Eve must have given Adam a pear. I gather from your laughter, Jack, that I'm not warm.
Yes, you're in the right, roughly in the right
direction. Did she give him something or other?
She did.
I mean, I know. Let us keep this.
If you could, could you possibly remember the Genesis quotation?
With fruit of the tree of
life. That's
right. Wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
So but it was fruit of some kind.
Yes.
Well,
like
it's just got to be more generalised, have we? So she gave him a fruit.
No, you're, two marks.
Fruit, she said.
What Genesis chapter 3 says, and this is Adam talking to God, who was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat," which was a pretty good bit of sneaking.
Gave him the tree?
The fruit of the tree.
Oh.
Sorry. And it wasn't until later, as far as I know, it starts turning up in medieval paintings that you can see quite clearly it was an apple, but to start
with... Well, listen, I've got a new idea. The oldest tree known, I think, is the prehistoric tree of Metasequoia, and I think she gave him a pine cone off the Metasequoia.
He said it tasted nice, and I doubt whether that would.
Well, after all, we all eat love pine
kernels. Well, apples surely didn't exist in those days.
I don't know.
I think the Metasequoia is quite...
The golden apples, the Hesperides, were oranges.
Oranges, that's right. But the alternative theory, of course, as when they'd done this, they got ashamed of their nakedness and dressed themselves in fig leaves. Possibly the fruit was a fig.
A fig.
Would we know? Anyway, the
not
point here.
Not in the heat.
I think they'd have been so repelled by the tree by then.
Not in the heat of the day. eat figs in the heat of the day. Diarrhea.
Well, there's none of that in Genesis. No, too much.
Exodus, perhaps.
Well, I heave a deep breath here and we go on to another round. This is a round of literate quotations. For two marks, who made these comments or observations on the art of writing? Dennis Norden, yours is, "Only a mediocre writer is always at his best."
Well, this sort of quotation I'm not at my best with. actually, Jack, I really don't know who it is.
Dr. Leavish.
Mm. No, you, I mean...
It's a very good line.
It's a good line. Oh, I don't know, somewhere like Cap Ferrar, I think you've got to go to.
Oh, well, around that part of the world.
Oh, I know.
Somerset Maugham.
Yes,
yes,
well done. A certain amount of help there.
Mile
and a half mile. Dennis Powell, "What is written without effort is in general read without pleasure."
I have a feeling that Frank is going to know this.
No, I do. I don't. Easy writing makes hard reading.
Which it does. Yes. Which it certainly does.
It sounds like Montaigne, is that kind of...
I think it's Lisa.
Nera Holmes, Frank, favourite character of yours.
Dr. Johnson.
No, I think we just...
No help.
Just get your two
no
on the pole.
No.
It comes in... Anecdotes by William Sewell, and it's a splendid example of Johnson's triumphant inconsistency, because just before he's been listening to a violinist playing and he says, "Difficult do you call it, sir? I wish it were impossible." And then he goes on says, "What's written without effort is in general read without pleasure." Good Johnsonianism. Fenkner, "Another damned thick square book, always scribble, scribble, scribble." Eh, Mr. Gibbon?
That's a bit of a gift, isn't it? William Henry, Duke of Gloucester.
Yes.
When Gibbon presented volume 2 of Decline and Fall of the Holy Roman Empire, "Unbended Knee," William Henry, Duke of Gloucester, indicated the Hanoverian dynasty's attitude towards literature.
Absolutely right. Two marks straight away. Anne Scott James, yours is, "3 hours a day will produce as much as a man ought to write."
Dennis, you've got any thoughts?
No, none at all. He did clues. Mathematical.
No. He did a regular stint of writing every
not
day.
Not Trollope, is it?
Yes.
No,
yes.
Really? I thought he did more than that.
Mm. No, that's
Anthony
right.
Trollope.
That's good.
It's a bit of a liberty, actually, because he had a steady job in the post office.
That's right. So,
he only needed to work 3 hours a day.
Well, it's rather like Lowry, who only painted in the evenings because he had some similar regular job. Hmm. It's Anthony Trollope's autobiography, chapter 15. 2 marks. Well, now we come to the last round, and to Dennis and Frank's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the lengthy applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Dennis, you'll remember your quotation is, "If I were a bell, I'd be ringing," and I'm told it's written by Frank Lesser, and it comes from Guys and Dolls.
Yes, you're told right, Jack. Almost one century ago, in the year 1876, the gentleman who invented the telephone picked up the instrument, said hello to his assistant who was stationed several miles away. Then, for quite a few minutes, they conducted the very first conversation over what were then the only two telephones in the whole world. Now, I mention that fact for only one reason. Because it was probably the very last time in recorded history that anyone made a telephone call without getting a wrong number, hearing the engage signal, or breaking in on a middle-aged woman saying, "It seems to have gone all red and angry looking." what I'm trying to say is that since that day in 1876, as far as the telephone's use in helping people communicate with each other is concerned, it's just been downhill all the way. Are you having trouble getting the dialing tone? An operator said to me once, after I'd mentioned to her that I'd made 7 unsuccessful attempts to speak to Frank, "I had no trouble at all getting the dialing tone. In fact, I get it halfway through every call I make." Now, this, I must mention, was after the introduction of what is known as the STD system, a system of dialing, which, according to the post office, was going to be one of the greatest time savers of the decade, which it certainly did prove to be. There's no doubt at all that by means of STD, you can now get 3 wrong numbers in the time it used to take to get only one. What is more, instead of, as before, being able to dial only local calls yourself, you can now dial direct to practically anywhere in the world. So not only has STD enabled us to get wrong numbers more quickly, we can now get them in 4 different continents. In other words, any simple message that you wish to pass over Alexander Bell's electrical instrument now entails so much dialing, it's led to a physical ailment hitherto unknown to medical science, cauliflower forefinger. Now, this is to say nothing of another development that Alexander probably never foresaw, the public telephone box. Now, there are several reasons why this is a unique amenity. In the first place, the telephone box is designed so that whichever direction you approach it from, the door is always on the other side. Secondly, all telephone boxes are constructed on what you might call the civil servant principle. Only 3 out of 4 work. as for that fourth one, the one that hasn't been visited by that pervert who goes around London telephone boxes gluing down receivers, that fourth one has a drawback as well. It's always got somebody already in it. And not just any somebody. Now, if you're one of those people who still hold on to the belief that the art of conversation is dead, let me offer you a suggestion. Just listen to the person who's talking inside the telephone box that you're standing outside. You don't know what aggro means until you see them start that movement where they take the receiver off one ear and place it more comfortably on the other ear. All in all, I sometimes wonder whether if Alexander Bell could now see how his invention turned out, would he have any regrets? If Alexander Graham Bell is looking down on what's happened with his machine, is he now wringing his hands in remorse? Because I'm sure of one thing. If I were a Bell, I'd be ringing.
That was a remorselessly accurate picture. And now we go on to Fechner and to his quotation, "Where are the snows of yesteryear," which is the medieval French poet François Villon in one of his ballads. So, Frank.
I had a thought the other week. I didn't do anything with it. I should probably have a thought in a week or two's time. There was a time when I had a thought, many thoughts every day. And the difference is now that, I don't know, one gets so tired during the day. Notice that, Dennis. And it's something to do with our modern life that the pattern of sleep and rest has changed. When the world and I was young, sleep somehow was no problem. My mother told me that I slept soundly and without batting an eyelid until I was 3 and a half. When I was first married, my wife had to prise me out of bed in the mornings with the prop from the clothesline. But now, I don't know, it's all rather different, and sleep is difficult with the stresses and strains of the modern world. If I sleep on my back, for instance, I snore. And in the morning, the uvula, that little sort of lump of stuff at the back of the throat, normally the size of a pea, has grown into a sort of hot, wet walnut. So that when I answer the phone in the morning, I say, "We have to say, oh, it's fog mirror here." They say, "Are you all right?" And I say, "Yes." You know, it gets better. And if I sleep on my left side, and not on my back when I snore, I sleep on my left side, I can hear my heartbeat. It goes, gudunk, gudunk, gudunk. Gudunk, gudunk, gudunk. I say, keep going, lad. Terribly worrying. Why can't we do what our forefathers did, you see? They didn't sleep at all. They worked late and they rose early, the Victorians and the Edwardians. And you get always, you read in journals of Arnold Bennett, you know, "I had my luncheon, I went and had 40 winks, and 20 minutes later awoke refreshed." And you try having... They loved 40 winks in those days. You know, it was a thing that they... You know, they did songs about it. You remember, "Oh, 40 winks, 40 winks." You can't have 40 winks nowadays. You try having 40 winks on the beach. You know, all old postcards show Dad asleep in a deck chair with a handkerchief knotted at all four corners, zizzing away happily. You know, 4 minutes on the average beach, and a frisbee gets you on the bridge of the nose. Or some moppet rushing along with an ice cream cone, it trips. And you get an earful of blackcurrant ripple. You just can't do it. And if I tried it in my study, and I had the 2 boiled eggs, inch of Cheshire, half a banana, went back into the study, lay back in the chair and tried to compose myself, 40 winks and a ziz, to make up this lost sleep. You can't do that with Afghans. Because Afghans do the nose trick. So they have these long, bony noses, and quite, really quite powerful beasts. It got his nose, her nose, under my thigh, and sort of jerked upwards. And the Burmese cat was asleep on my head at the time. I rather upset the centre of gravity, and I was over on my back, over the back of the chair. You know, it's absolutely useless nowadays. Why can't we go back to those old times when one could catch up on one's rest during the day? You can get a night's sleep nowadays by buying one of those pills, which sounds like an ancient classical city, Ilium or Virinalum or something. But where, I ask you, where is the snooze of yesteryear?
Well, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the story contest, but the overall contest on this occasion is a draw.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norton, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longman. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Schreier.